From the heart of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., bringing compelling interviews, insightful analysis, taking you beyond the headlines and sound bites into conversations with our nation's leaders and newsmakers, all from a biblical worldview. Washington Watch with Tony Perkins starts now.
I'm signing a presidential memorandum to establish the Memphis Safe Task Force, and it's very important because of the crime that's going on, not only in Memphis, in many cities, and we're going to take care of all of them. Step by step, just like we did in D.C., we have virtually no crime in D.C. right now.
That was President Donald Trump announcing the launch of the Memphis Safe Task Force, modeled after the recent federal surge here in Washington, D.C., as a part of a broader effort to tackle crime. Welcome to the September 16th edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Thanks so much for tuning in. Well, coming up, as President Trump launches a new federal task force to combat violent crime in Memphis, many community leaders point to a deeper issue at the heart of the crisis, the breakdown of the family. We'll take a closer look, and we'll talk with Tennessee Congressman John Rose. Violence has surged in Syria since the fall of the Assad regime, with Christians and other religious minorities facing heightened risk. Indiana Congressman Marlon Stutzman was among the first U.S. lawmakers to visit Damascus after the fall of Assad and meet with a rebel commander who is now the leader of Syria, Ahmad al-Sharar. Congressman Stutzman will join us later. And with the September 30th funding deadline approaching, it's deja vu on Capitol Hill. Another budget fight looms. Congressman Andy Harris will join me shortly to discuss efforts to extend funding. All of that today. Coming up, also, Israel launched a major ground operation in Gaza City against Hamas. CBN News Middle East News Bureau Chief Chris Mitchell will bring us the latest from Israel. All right, we begin with the safety of America's cities, demonstrating an ongoing push to restore law and order and safeguard families. President Donald Trump yesterday announced the Memphis Safe Task Force, uniting federal agencies, the National Guard, and local law enforcement to address rising violence and to make neighborhoods safer. Joining me now is Washington Stand reporter Casey Harper. Casey, what actions is President Trump taking to address the urban violence in Memphis, and how does this initiative reflect his broader effort to protect the American family and safeguard neighborhoods?
Yeah, thanks, Tony. President Donald Trump established that task force yesterday at the White House. The president says this effort is part of a broader initiative to protect families and restore law and order in America's cities. Of course, this same effort is modeled after the successful federal law enforcement surge in Washington, D.C., which included the National Guard, FBI, ICE, and Department of Homeland Security, as well as the U.S. Marshal Service. They're expected to also go to Memphis. They'll be working in partnership with the National Guard and local law enforcement. Attorney General Pam Bondi will reportedly lead the operation.
This task force will be a replica of our extraordinarily successful efforts here. And you'll see it's a lot of the same thing, although the numbers here are really something. They're really bad. Now, we did send FBI in about 4 months ago to work, and it brought some of the numbers down. And they did a great job, but we're sending in the big force now.
That clip was President Trump making the federal case for support in the city, Tony.
Now, Casey, we've discussed before that people desire security. You and I have talked about that. But while these surges against crime are welcomed, they are only dealing with the symptoms. We have to address the root cause of the crime.
That's absolutely right, Tony. So a major factor contributing to Memphis's high crime rate is the breakdown of the family, as you said. According to a 2013 study published by Marriage and Religion Research Institute, only 17% of teenagers in Memphis have been raised by both of their married biological parents. That's one of the lowest rates in the nation. And this lack of family stability is strongly linked to higher rates of poverty, school failure, and violent crime. So strengthening the family unit, it's not just a cultural priority, but it's a practical solution to reduce crime and improve opportunity for the next generation.
You know, that should not surprise us. I mean, Scripture is very clear that parents are central to the education of their children. I mean, Scripture says, Proverbs, train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. I mean, the evidence is overwhelming. Strong families raise strong children build strong communities. And here at the Family Research Council, we champion the family built on a biblical foundation. We're going to talk a little bit more about that later with Tennessee Congressman John Rose here in the program. Casey, I want to switch gears a little bit. What's the latest in the investigation into the assassination of Charlie Kirk?
Yeah, that's right, Tony. So there's a Sunday funeral planned for Charlie Kirk in Arizona. As far as the investigation, Utah officials held a press conference today where they announced seven formal charges, which includes aggravated murder. That's an important charge because they've also announced that they are going to seek the death penalty in this case. They'll need that aggravated murder charge. They released many details, although not all of them. The prosecutor said that he doesn't want to taint the future jury pool and wants to do justice to the suspected shooter. But we do have confirmation of many of the rumors and initial reports that the shooter had become increasingly pro-trans, pro-gay, and anti-Charlie Kirk, saying he was spreading hate. And it really did come down to a political and spiritual motive here, Tony.
All right. Well, thanks for that update, Casey. I want to turn quickly to the Middle East. Israel launched a large offensive in Gaza City today. This follows Secretary of State Marco Rubio, his visit to Israel, where he reiterated American support for Israel's war against Hamas. Now, today he's in Doha meeting with officials in Qatar. Casey, what's the purpose of Secretary Rubio's stop there in Qatar?
Yeah, Rubio's visit to Doha comes at a pivotal moment as Israel is escalating its military operations against Hamas in Gaza. Now, Rubio's discussion with Qatar's leadership there is focused on finalizing a robust defense agreement between the U.S. and Qatar, highlighting the need for that stronger security cooperation in the region. Rubio, of course, has been a vocal support of Israel's right to defend itself, and this trip just underscores and strengthens that commitment and alliance between the U.S. and Israel.
All right. Thanks, Casey. Later in the show, CBN Middle East Bureau Chief Chris Mitchell will join us from Israel with more details on the situation in Israel and Gaza. Casey, final story. What actions are Christians in America taking to bring the issue of violence against Christian minorities in the Middle East to the attention of Secretary Rubio?
Well, Family Research Council led a coalition urging the U.S. government, specifically addressing Rubio, who, as we just said, is in the Middle East. And they wanted to take immediate action to protect religious minorities in Syria. So leaders of FRC and other Christian organizations are calling for the establishment of a humanitarian corridor between Haiti and Ceuta to ensure Druze and Christian communities that they can move safely and receive direct aid, bypassing Damascus. So with Rubio on the ground of the region, this is a critical opportunity for the U.S. to reinforce its commitment to these vulnerable communities, Tony.
All right. Thank you, Casey. We're going to discuss this issue in more detail later with Congressman Marlon Stutzman. But first, I want to go further into the spending fight that Congress is now in the thick of. Joining me now to give us the latest on this is Congressman Andy Harris, who's the chairman of the House Freedom Caucus and a member of the House Appropriations Committee. He represents the 1st Congressional District of Maryland. Dr. Harris, welcome back to Washington Watch. I know you're just leaving the floor from vote, so I appreciate you joining us. Give us the latest.
Sure. So I think what we're going to do is tomorrow we're going to vote on what we call the rule to bring a bill to the floor that will extend government funding, avoid a shutdown till November 20th. Of course, that partially kicks the can down the road, but it allows us to give the appropriations process one more chance before we decide to just continue with continuing resolutions, which, again, Tony, I don't mind because they don't increase spending. They keep spending level. And of course, when your inflation is between 2.5% and 3%, you actually have a 2.5% to 3% cut in actual size of government if you keep the spending level.
Now, there were some elements in those CRs. I think the COVID set-asides, those are all of the bad policies still in there that were under the Biden administration? How are we going to deal with that?
Well, look, this administration is just not following, again, they're not going to follow some of the prescriptions in the previous Biden budgets. It will keep the funding level. There was talk that we were going to somehow include, and, Chuck Schumer has mentioned that he wants COVID era Obamacare subsidies, enhanced subsidies included in this bill. The House bill is not going to include it. Okay. I don't think that he's going to have the juice to get it added in the Senate. Again, between now and November 20th, maybe he gets the juice to do it. He doesn't have it now. Again, these COVID-era policies, these COVID-era giveaways really to insurance companies really should just go away.
All right. You've been around a while, Dr. Harris. November 21st, backdrop Thanksgiving. I mean, is there going to be pressure exerted there? I mean, that's what we've seen in the past. Everybody wants to get out of town, and so pressure is applied to adopt something that may not be the best.
Well, I think the real pressure would be if we had put this off until the week before Christmas, because then you're getting out of town for a couple of weeks. It's the holiday. It's the end of the year. You don't want to spoil anybody's Christmas with a short government shutdown. I think November 20th is all right. Is it as good as I had hoped for? No, I'd hoped that it would be just into October, a few weeks into October, see if we can get the appropriations process going. I think by then we'll figure out it really won't be able to get going. But November 20th is all right. It's not as bad as December, the end of December. And the speaker has gone publicly and said in the past and currently, he really doesn't want an end of year omnibus bill, which is really what we're afraid of, because right. that always involves increased spending.
Now, the speaker has repeatedly said that he wants to get back to normal order when it comes to appropriations. And you said, you know, this gives you time to do some of the appropriations. The House has been doing that. The House has advanced. I think you've already approved three. You may have done more by now. But the White House is actually wanting to continue with CRs. They feel like that's a better way because they don't have to negotiate with Democrats.
That's absolutely right. So the House has actually passed all 12 bills through committee, 5 bills through the floor. The Senate has not done the same. They have passed 3 bills through the floor. We are attempting to negotiate those bills. One of those bills is mine. It's the agriculture bill. The other one's military construction and the Veterans Administration. And the third one, the legislative branch ones. But we are going to attempt to negotiate those. But those are the three probably easiest ones. So once that process is done, we'll see if we can do any more. I think by the end of November, it'll become obvious we can't do any more.
But it is important that Congress gets back to doing appropriations bills. I mean, we really haven't seen that for almost 20 years, where this regular process of Congress advancing these 12 appropriations bills, because policy is included in those appropriations.
That's absolutely right. But I tell you, Tony, when they wrote the law that set out the process, it's been about 50 years. And the size of the federal government and the scope of the federal government and the amount of money appropriated by the federal government has greatly increased since then. So I think it's time that we look at 2-year appropriations like some states do, perhaps every year appropriate for defense, because defense has to be, up to the minute, up to the moment expenditures. But for everything else, we probably ought to go to 2-year cycles. It's going to take us that long to spend the time requisite on each of these departments to make sure that we're doing the job right, not just doing the job fast.
So is there some internal discussion about changing the budgetary process?
There has been for about 10 years. And I think that, at some point, people are just going to finally decide this process is not working. You know, this year we even haven't even passed, the budget bill that's been called for, which is supposed to prescribe to the House what the level of spending is going to be for this year, fiscal year 26. We haven't even passed that. So there is no aspect of the Budget Control Act from the 70s that we are adhering to. The president was late getting his budget, because, again, these budgets are huge.
They're big, yeah.
They're
huge.
Big. And realistically, look, we're humans. We just can't deal. We don't have the bandwidth to deal with things that size. So I think it's about time we go to, again, 2-year budgeting. Look, if we have to make changes, small course corrections, we can do it in a smaller bill, but we're set for 2 years.
That sounds like a very reasonable approach. Something has to be done to get Congress back in control of the purse strings. Congressman Andy Harris, always great to see you. Folks, stick around. John Rose joins us next.
3 years ago, the Supreme Court issued its historic Dobbs decision, a ruling that overturned Roe v. Wade, which for nearly 50 years imposed abortion on demand, silencing voters and bypassing the democratic process across the country. The Dobbs decision was a huge step forward against abortion, but it didn't outright ban it. It returned the power to the people. Now, 29 states have laws on the books protecting life. However, there's a catch. Abortion numbers since Dobbs have actually gone up, with an increase of 12% since 2020, climbing from 930,000 to over 1 million in each of the most recent years. So how can this be? The answer is simple: the abortion drug. Today, over 60% of U.S. abortions involve abortion drugs, many of these without medical oversight. In 2021, the Biden administration quietly removed bare minimum long-standing safety protocols for the abortion drug that have existed for 20 years to protect women from life-threatening risks and ensuring informed consent. The Biden DOJ then declared that they would not enforce the Comstock Act, which prevents the mailing of anything that causes an abortion. This is not only illegal, but also dangerous. A study shows nearly 11% of women who take the abortion drug end up in the emergency room with serious complications. Unless the Trump administration reverses these reckless Biden-era policies, pro-life laws will remain largely symbolic. Without a full review and repeal of mifepristone, unborn lives will remain in grave danger and pregnant mothers will remain at risk. Let's stand for life and end this mail-order abortion drug pipeline. Sign the petition urging the Trump administration to take action at frc.org/stopchemicalabortion.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. Family Research Council invites you to join our Stand on the Word Bible reading plan as we reflect upon the life of Jesus, the Word who dwelt among us. Come with us and discover the glory of the Word. Read the Gospels and witness the life-changing story of Jesus, his life, death, and resurrection. Come read how Jesus transformed the lives of common people and how those same people transformed the known world through the power of the Holy Spirit. Come with us for 10 to 15 minutes a day and read the entire New Testament before the new year. Find our Bible reading plan and daily devotionals from Tony Perkins at frc.org/Bible. Join us and stand on the Word.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Thanks so much for joining us. All right, coming up next month, October the 17th, 18th, is the Pray, Vote, Stand Summit at Calvary Chapel, Chino Hills in Southern California. If you'd like to find out more about joining us, and I invite you to join us, go to prayvotestand.org, prayvotestand.org to register and to find out more. Well, yesterday, as a part of his administration's crackdown on crime, as we were talking about earlier, President Trump signed a memorandum establishing a task force to tackle violent crime in Memphis, Tennessee. According to FBI data, Memphis had the highest violent crime rate in the country last year. Memphis also had the highest property crime rate and the third highest murder rate in the U.S. So how will the Memphis Safe Task Force restore law and order in the city? And will it be taking pages from the Trump administration's actions in D.C.? Joining me now to discuss this, Congressman John Rose, who represents the 6th Congressional District of Tennessee. Congressman Rose, welcome to Washington Watch. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mr. Perkins, for having me on today.
So for 30 years, Democrats have controlled Memphis. How's it going?
Well, I think by the measure, certainly, of crime and other areas of civic measurement, it's not going well. Democrats, as you say, have controlled every level of Memphis government for 30 years, and I think we'd have to give them a failing grade, and particularly when it comes to the safety and security of Memphians and the desirability of the Bluff City, given the crime problem that we see there.
And Congressman, a number of years ago in our Marriage and Religion Research Institute here at the Family Research Council, that which is now spun off and it's an independent organization, studied what was called the Belonging Index. And what they found in Memphis was that only 17% of children under the age of 18 had actually grown up in a home with a mom and dad that they were biologically related to. That was one of the lowest in the country. We saw that in Baltimore. We've seen it in other cities that have had violent crime issues. So while many applaud this effort to address the immediate symptoms, there are some underlying issues here that have to be addressed as well.
Absolutely. And I think you're right to point to the fundamental foundations of Western civilization and Christian faith. We've seen that degraded in Memphis. Too many fatherless children growing up in homes where they're not getting the influence of a two-parent household for those of us who experienced that growing up, we know how powerful that can be in helping you to find yourself and to have a basis for understanding the world and knowing your place in it. And that's a problem in Memphis, Tennessee. And it's one that, frankly, I think, as the president correctly observed last week, a lot of that is around faith,
right,
and having a religious understanding of your place in the world. And when the faith of this country is not where it should be, and faith in Memphis is not where it should be, then Memphis is not going to thrive. And so the longer term solutions in Memphis are not about stopping crime, that they're about changing the hearts and minds of
right.
Memphians.
So Congressman Rose, let me talk about that, because I know you have concerns about all of the state of Tennessee. Even though you represent one district, you're focused as well on the entire state. So I think what the president is doing, like he did here in D.C., by stabilizing the environment, by containing crime and reducing it, it's kind of a reset. But you've got, when that reset comes, you've got to come in quickly. What are some of the things that, you know, non-governmental organizations like the faith community, churches, and others can do in the state of Tennessee, particularly, specifically speaking about Memphis, as this reset is going to take place?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, as is true for the nation, I think it's equally true for Memphis, or more so. We need a revival of faith in Memphis, Tennessee, and a revival of the values that are fundamental to the Christian faith. And until we have that, the founders correctly observed that democracy, the republic, could only survive if we had a moral people. And I think you see that on display in places like Memphis, Tennessee, where we've seen society degrade, we've seen morality brought into question. And I think for those who advocate for a world where faith is less important, they need to take heed of what happens in places like Memphis when you
right.
see those institutions decline.
And it seems like what we've seen in Memphis and other cities, they're not alone. You have, you know, crime gets out of hand, and so the leaders just kind of let it go. I mean, you look at in 2022, Shelby County overhauled its bail system at behest of the district attorney, instituting this secured cash bail only as a last resort. So, I mean, basically just, you know, saying, hey, we're going to let you go. I mean, you can't refuse to enforce the law and expect people to abide by the law.
That's right. And I think there's too much misunderstanding about criminal justice in this country. I think we saw it proven long ago that kind of a broken windows policy when it comes to crime is what works. Certainly any parent of young children knows that if you don't raise them up correctly, if you don't teach them when they're young, then you're going to pay a heavy price for that later on. And
right.
and so it's human nature that we're always testing boundaries. And if we're going to live together in a civil society, then we've got to have laws, and those laws have to be enforced. And we can't look at macro measures of, you know, who are committing the crimes and somehow conclude that justice is not being equally dispensed when, you know, the crimes are not being equally committed. And so we've got to have a law and order in Memphis, Tennessee, and the people of Memphis ultimately have to decide how they want to live.
Right.
Do they want to live in a crime-ridden town where safety is not available and where their children can't grow up with the security of being able to go outside and play in their lawns without fear of being shot? And if that's the world they want, then that's the world they've gotten from 30 years of poor choices with respect to their leaders.
I would venture to say, Congressman Rose, having been a police officer in the inner city of Baton Rouge that has had its own share of crime problems, that there are a lot of grandmothers there that want safer streets. They want a place for their grandkids, that they're, many of them are raising, to be able to walk on the streets and be safe. They need the help. I think this is a part of the help to reset. But as you pointed out, the faith community and others have to step in to win hearts and minds. So I think it's an all hands on deck approach if we really want to turn the situation around in this country. Congressman, we're out of time. I want to thank you for joining us. Appreciate your insights and your work on Capitol Hill.
Thank you for having me on. It's a great honor and privilege to serve the people of Tennessee.
All right, Congressman John Rose of Tennessee. All right, don't go away. When we come back, Congressman Marlon Stutson joins us.
Download the new Stand Firm app for Apple and Android phones today. You can join a wonderful community of fellow believers. We've created a special place for you to access news from a biblical perspective. Read and listen to daily devotionals, pray for current events, and more. Share the Stand Firm app with your friends, family, and church members. And of course, stand firm wherever you go.
At Family Research Council, defending the family isn't just a mission, it's our daily calling. Every team member at FRC uses their God-given talents to stand for biblical truth, protect life, and uphold religious freedom.
Here at Family Research Council, we face many threats to the family, threats that have been with us for some time. Abortion, the gender ideology threat, the attacks on marriage, the attacks on parental authority, and the attacks on religious freedom. We have to promote, support, strengthen, and incentivize family growth so families take their place in society in a place of honor.
I'm defending the family by working in the Center for Biblical Worldview to provide cutting-edge research and resources for pastors, ministry leaders, and Christian parents.
Through my work at the Washington Stand, I passionately defend what God has defined for marriage and family. I don't see the Washington Stand as just a place to talk about cultural events. It's a place to share biblical truth. It's a perfect outlet to advance and defend what God has defined as good, true, and beautiful.
Because of you, we're able to frame things in such a way that help Christians stand for truth on the things that matter most, like life, faith, family, and freedom.
Thank you for standing with us.
Thank you for your support. It is so critical to the work that we at Family Research Council are doing day to day as we support and strengthen the family. So thank you.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. And as we just finished up there just a moment ago with Congressman Rose talking about Memphis and the crime issue, I would encourage you, you know, whatever city you live in, you can make a difference just by praying for your city. And start a prayer group and begin to pray for your city officials, no matter where you are, that they would make the right decisions that you might live in peace in your city. And if you'd like help with that, just email us here at the Family Research Council. Email tony@tonyperkins.com. Happy to help you with our some of our prayer team leaders can help you organize that for your community. Well, since the fall of the brutal Assad regime late last year, there has been growing concern for the safety of religious minorities in Syria, Druze, Christians, and others, as they face an escalating wave of violence. Now, some have suggested that the attacks are a part of a deliberate campaign of terror by foreign jihadis, Assad loyalists, and militias unleashed by the self-declared leader, Ahmad al-Sharar. And now there is growing pressure on the Trump administration for the U.S. to intervene, or at least to allow Israel, who wants to help, to take action. Joining me now to discuss this is Congressman Marlon Stutson, who was one of the first members of Congress to actually visit Syria and meet with the new Syrian leader after the fall of the Assad regime. He represents the 3rd Congressional District of Indiana. Congressman Stutson, welcome back to Washington Watch. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. Great to be with you this evening.
I know we actually spoke with you when you were in Syria after you met with the new leader. You said then, when you met with him, you were cautiously optimistic about possibly more friendly relationships between the U.S. and Syria. Where do you stand today?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot of opportunity right now in Syria for the new government there. And al-Shara is a young 42-year-old with a very checkered past. He was part of al-Qaeda. He was part of HTS. He's been part of terrorist organizations. And he has been able to come to power in Syria without a shot being fired. And Assad is gone. Assad was a brutal dictator, killing, you know, almost a million or more of his own people through political genocide. And one thing that we want to make sure happens in Syria is that we don't go from one brutal dictator to another one. But one of the symptoms that we're already seeing is that Christians and Druze have been slaughtered in the southeastern part of Syria. And so I appreciate you covering this, because this is an opportunity. It's maybe days, maybe a couple of weeks here that we have a window here to put pressure on the new Syrian government by you know, making sure if they want to show the rest of the world that they're not going to kill their own people, that they're going to protect all backgrounds. Syria is a very diverse country. You have Christians, you have Druze, Kurds, Alawite, Muslims, and Bedouins, and a whole variety of others. It's a very dangerous place, but my hope and prayer is that that the new government moves in a direction to protect everybody. But right now, the Christians and Druze have been under attack, and that's why we've been talking to our leaders and sending a letter to Secretary of State Rubio to be sure that, and this is what I find interesting, Tony, is that Christians don't have militia in Syria. They don't have militia in the Middle East necessarily. So they're dependent on the Druze to protect them or the Kurds from the government that is attacking them. And so that's why we really need to be praying for the Christians and the Druze right now for safety, for the ability to feed themselves. We need a humanitarian aid corridor into Soweda to be sure that they have the food and the water and the medical resources that they need to be able to survive this. And we're going to keep putting pressure on Damascus that this is not coming from Damascus, but there's a lot of signals here that we're trying to sort out where this is actually coming from.
So very quickly, the situation is that in the southern part of Syria, where you have the Druze population, the Christian population, they were attacked by jihadists that came in from other places. There's no direct connection to the Syrian government, although they've blocked access to others to get in. And so these Christians and Druze are kind of they're kind of surrounded. They can't get in or out. Yeah. And they've poisoned their water. And so they're, as you said, there's just a narrow window there. They're going to either die of starvation and lack of water and other resources. That's the reason for the humanitarian corridor, which Israel is ready to do. Israel wants, yes, to help, but it's like the United States is holding them back.
Well, and you know, so the Druze population, there's a large Druze population in Syria and in Israel. And so the relationship between Israel and the Druze is very strong. As Prime Minister Netanyahu said, the brother of my brother is my brother. And so that's why they have such a strong bond between Israel and the Druze and the Christians there. And so, you know, the Israelis are ready to help. But for whatever reason, we're trying to find out why are they not allowing humanitarian aid to go in. Now, I was told last week that the UN is delivering humanitarian aid, but it's not just directly into Soweda where we need it.
We saw how that worked out in Gaza.
Yep. That's right. No, that's exactly right. And that's why we're putting pressure on our own, you know, asking our own leaders to be aware of what's happening in Soweda, that these people are they're sitting ducks. I mean, they don't have the ability to defend themselves against these jihadists and ISIS. And I'll tell you what, if this is connected back to Damascus, it's going to make it very hard for members of Congress to support lifting any sanctions for Syria. And that's why this is critical that this get cleared up as quickly as possible. I think the evidence that comes from Damascus is if there's a humanitarian aid, these roads that you mentioned, if they're not blocked, then that means it's not coming from Damascus. But right now, the roads are blocked, which it is not a good signal.
All right, Congressman Marlon Sussman, we're out of time, but we're going to follow back up to get some clear action items as we see what the Trump administration is willing to do to help, maybe just let Israel, you know, give them the latitude to help solve the problem for the Druze there. But I appreciate you taking the leadership on this, and thanks for joining us today to bring us up to date.
Absolutely. Thank you for covering this.
Absolutely. Folks, we need to pray for them, other brothers and sisters in Christ that are at risk. Next, we go to Israel, so don't go away.
Family Research Council is committed to advancing faith, family, and freedom from the East Coast to the West. So FRC is going to Southern California for this year's Pray, Vote, Stand Summit, October 17th and 18th at Calvary Chapel, Chino Hills. Join us for this powerful gathering of Christians desiring cultural renewal and spiritual revival. The Pray, Vote, Stand Summit brings together Christian leaders, issue experts, and government officials for a time of prayer, inspiration, and action. Together, we will seek God's guidance for our nation and engage in meaningful discussions on the intersection of faith, government, and culture.
If the spiritual foundations and the cultural walls of our nation are to be rebuilt, we all have a role to play. May we each find our place on the wall as we build for biblical truth. Register now at PrayVoteStand.org. That's PrayVoteStand.org.
Jennifer, it's so exciting to be here with you today talking about our new book, Embracing God's Design. Who is actually going to benefit from reading this book in your view?
There are so many different audiences that can benefit. The first one are counselors themselves, right? Because we have some material in there where we really address the gender dysphoria diagnosis and what is wrong with it. We have information for people who are wanting to go back to embracing God's design for their life.
This is really magical to have the therapist and the individual who suffered come together and write about why this is happening and why we're seeing this.
And we brought all of that experience to the table. We want to see people walking in the fullness of who God has called them to be and not a false identity.
Order today at EmbraceTheDesign.com.
How should Christians think about the thorny issues shaping our culture? How should Christians address deceitful ideas like transgenderism, critical theory, or assisted suicide? How can Christians navigate raising children in a broken culture, the war on gender roles, or rebuilding our once great nation? Outstanding is a podcast from the Washington Stand dedicated to these critical conversations. Outstanding seeks to tear down what our corrupt culture lifts up with an aim to take every thought and every idea captive to the obedience of Christ. Whether policies or partisan politics, whether conflict in America or conflict abroad, join us and our guests as we examine the headlines through the lens of Scripture and explore how Christians can faithfully exalt Christ in all of life. Follow Outstanding on your favorite podcast app and look for new episodes each week.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Thanks so much for tuning in. Let me invite you to join like-minded believers for the Pray Vote Stand Summit, October 17th and 18th in Chino Hills, California. Now, this powerful event brings together Christian leaders, issue experts, and government officials for a time of prayer, inspiration, and action. This is going to be at Calvary Chapel, Chino Hills, with my friend Pastor Jack Hibbs. To find out more and to register, visit PrayVoteStand.org. That's PrayVoteStand.org. I hope you will be there. Our word for today comes from Acts chapter 18, as Paul proclaims the gospel in Corinth during his second missionary journey. One night the Lord spoke to him, saying, "Do not be afraid, but speak, and do not keep silent, for I am with you. For I have many people in this city." You know, Paul was no timid soul. From the start of his ministry, he had been maligned, stoned, beaten, jailed, and left for dead. Yet even the courageous can grow tired. Corinth was loud, immoral, and resistant, opposing him at every turn, even in the synagogue. Crispus believed and many were baptized, but yet there was opposition. So into that weariness came God's word. "Do not fear. Keep speaking. I'm with you. You are not alone." Those three assurances steady us today. First, the command, keep speaking, truth with grace. Second, the presence, the Lord stands with us when we stand for Him. And third, people, God has unseen allies already placed in the city. Often it's our bold obedience that reveals them. When rejection tempts you to dial it back, remember Corinth, don't keep silent. The Lord is with you. And He has more partners in the harvest than you can see. For more on our journey through the Bible, text Bible to 67742. Last night, after much anticipation, Israeli Defense Forces expanded their ground activity in Gaza City, the main stronghold for Hamas. The IDF says the expansion marks the start of a new phase of their operation. Could it be the final phase, with time running out for ceasefire and hostage release talks? Well, joining me from Israel to discuss the latest on this is Chris Mitchell, the Middle East Bureau Chief for CBN News. Chris, welcome back to Washington Watch, and thanks for joining us tonight.
Sure. Great to be with you, Tony. A lot of things happening here in Israel.
There always is. There always is. Let's talk about this latest phase, this new phase. Is this the final phase?
It does seem like that, Tony. I think it was early morning when the tanks went in, and this is called Gideon's Chariots Phase 2 or Phase B, and they have about 60,000 reservists that have called up, in addition to the 70,000 that troops are already in there. So this is the idea that they will encircle Gaza City. This is the last major stronghold of Hamas, and potentially, Tony, maybe the end of the war could be in sight. Certainly, they want to make sure that they can do everything they can to free those remaining 48 hostages. Hamas, by the way, is actually threatening to bring some of those hostages up above ground. You may have known that President Trump has said if that's going to happen, that all bets are off, and he called it a human atrocity that we've never seen before. But right now, it does look like the IDF has been preparing the ground for at least a couple of weeks by eliminating much of the Hamas command centers that had been set up in many of these high-rise towers in Gaza City. They had been systematically destroyed, and now the IDF obviously believes it's time for the ground forces to go in. The other thing, Tony, that the IDF has been doing has been sending leaflets, sending text messages, calling people on the phone, telling them to get out of harm's way because Gaza City has become a dangerous combat zone. About 350,000, we believe, have already left. And now that the IDF is going in, people are actually taking that warning seriously. Hamas, on the other side, has actually been releasing, and we heard this earlier today from the IDF international spokesman. IDF has been sending leaflets to the Gazan people saying that it's a safe zone, it's a humanitarian area, just trying to keep them, as some people have said, the largest human shield right now. So they want to keep their people there in as a barrier to the IDF. The IDF is trying to get them out, get them out of harm's way, get them to a humanitarian zone. This really undermines this whole idea that Israel is trying to commit genocide in Gaza.
I want to talk about that for just a moment, Chris, because that independent United Nations commission has concluded that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. But here we see, as you just mentioned, the IDF saying that Hamas has turned Gaza City into the largest human shield in history, preventing many of these people from leaving. They're hiding behind them. So this makes this operation even more delicate because the international community is watching.
Exactly. And this report that comes up, Tony, everything that I've seen about what the IDF has done here in Gaza City really doesn't compute in terms of genocide. They've been sending in 2 million tons of food to the people of Gaza. That's almost one ton per person, and they've also sent in medical supplies. We've reported on what's called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, and an attempt to bypass Hamas, which has been stealing, looting much of the aid going in to the UN, but Israel has been pouring this aid into. They've also set up, this medical supplies and medical tents. So they're trying to balance both the military operation, and you can see Prime Minister Netanyahu talking to some of the troops, trying to balance a very delicate, a very sensitive military operation, urban warfare, in complicating it even more is tunnel warfare, at the same time to have a massive humanitarian operation to get these people out of harm's way so they can have clean water, food, and medical attention.
I know that most of modern combat takes place in these cities, but that is the most difficult type of warfare to wage, especially when you have civilians intermixed in the population. I want to talk in just a moment more about the United Nations international community, because coming up at the end of this month, the United Nations will be meeting here in America in New York, and they'll be discussing a Palestinian state. But before I do that, I just want to point out that Israel not only is still engaged there with Gaza, but earlier today, Yemen launched another rocket was launched from Yemen by the Houthis. So there continues to be this ongoing attack from multiple fronts.
Yeah, Tony, we're talking to you right now from Magdala in the Galilee, and on the way up Route 6, one of the main highways here in Israel, an air raid siren went off. Many people literally were getting off, stopping on the side of the road, getting in ditches because the Houthis had fired yet another ballistic missile, this one with cluster munitions, which can cause even more death or destruction. So the IDF has struck again, the main port there in Yemen that the Houthis are using for their terrorist activities. Israel continues to bombard that, and yet the Houthis continue to send drones or UAVs or even ballistic missiles here at Israel. So they're trying to do what they can to eliminate this threat to the people of Israel.
I want to talk about that for just a moment, because the Houthis and Yemen has been hammered, first by the United States, Israel repeatedly. Where are they getting their support? How are they sustaining this attack on Israel?
Well, apparently they have an arsenal of weapons that have been either underground or that can continue to come out that haven't yet been hit by the U.S. or Israel. The Israel has actually struck much of the leadership of the Houthis, just like they've done with Hezbollah, Hamas, and even Iran. But they seemingly have some arsenals that they continue to draw on. It's not a lot. Usually, in Israel, there may be two or three a week. You get sirens and people go into the bomb shelters. But despite all the pummeling they've taken, they can still fire at least one or two or three a week.
It's quite amazing, actually, that they continue, even though they've been hammered so much. In the midst of all of this, as Israel juggles Gaza, the attacks from coming from Yemen, working to coordinate humanitarian aid into Gaza, despite all of that, we see this global campaign to delegitimize Israel.
Yeah.
In fact, as I mentioned, coming up to the end of the month at the United Nations, we have France, I think Spain now, the UK saying that they will weigh in on calling for a Palestinian state, which is the giving up sovereignty over Judea and Samaria, the heartland of Israel. I would have to think that the resolve there in Israel is growing stronger each day as we see the international community taking these steps.
Very much so. I don't think there's the whole idea of a Palestinian state, especially after October 7th, is a non-starter here. Tony, the Knesset has voted not to allow a Palestinian state. I think the majority, the far large majority of Israelis will not tolerate that. But yet the international community and many of these nations are making their decision to call for a Palestinian state. On the other hand, Tony, and I know we mentioned this, that Secretary of State Marco Rubio came here and he paid a visit just last night. He was in the city of David. I know a place you've been to where they have officially opened what they call the Pilgrimage Road. This goes from the Pool of Siloam all the way up to the Temple Mount. They've been excavating this for years, and this demonstrates in such a powerful way the presence of the Jewish people here in the land of Israel for thousands of years. This road was built by Pontius Pilate, a road obviously that that Jesus would have walked on as well. And you're seeing video when Secretary of State Marco Rubio came. He went exactly right there to the Western Wall with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, U.S. Ambassador Mike Huckabee. But this delegitimization, Tony, is a very real threat. In fact, yesterday, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu was talking to a group of about 250 lawmakers from the United States, from all 50 states. And he was saying that Israel is being besieged by a campaign. It's an organized campaign to delegitimize Israel and the Jewish people. And much, he named out China and he mentioned Qatar, that are organizing and funding some of this, using social media in the West, and trying to undermine the whole legitimacy of Israel and the Jewish people. And this whole notion of genocide is spread as well. And that's why many people feel like this could be an even more dangerous threat to Israel than any threat that Hamas may oppose.
Well, I think the Jewish people understand the reality of what follows delegitimizing a people, marginalizing them, What comes next is what we saw in the 1930s, a century before.
That's exactly right, Tony. And we see it in anti-Semitic acts, whether it's in Paris or Sydney or London. You know, the whole idea that the Jewish people are evil and that they're fostering this genocide. They're trying to eliminate the Palestinian people. If you come here and see for yourself, it's simply not true. But this lie gets spread around the world, and then that spawns this kind of hatred for the Jewish people and wherever they may be around the world. That's why many of the Jewish people that I have talked to, they're actually considering moving here to Israel, believing that this would be a far safer place than where they may be living now.
And the numbers show that, despite October the 7th. In fact, since October 7th, there's been an increase in the number of Jewish people moving back moving to Israel. It's quite remarkable. We just have a couple minutes left, Chris Mitchell. I want to go back to the visit by Secretary of State Marco Rubio there in his meetings. Any discussion of the sovereignty over Judea and Samaria?
Nothing that I know that he spoke directly to. But certainly that would be one of the issues, because as we know, Tony, as this increased drive for a Palestinian state grows within Israel, there's a growing counter move, so to speak, to declare sovereignty over Judea and Samaria. Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, was here just about 2 months ago. The highest ranking member of the government to actually be in Judea and Samaria. So that is a very real possibility, especially as we see probably September 22nd is when many of these nations will declare the recognition of a Palestinian state. Where that state's going to go, how it's going to be established is certainly a very open question. But many people say, look at Gaza. Gaza was a de facto Palestinian state since 2007 to October 7, 2023, and look what happened.
Just about a minute left here, Chris. Before he left, Secretary Rubio said, quote, "We have a short window of time in which a ceasefire and hostage deal can happen." He estimated it could be a matter of days or maybe weeks. What do you know on the latest on those negotiations?
Well, right now it doesn't seem like anything's happening just yet, but the window of time will be, and it's getting closer, it's closing faster and faster, Tony, with this move into Gaza City. They believe that if the negotiations did break through, that they would stop this this IDF move into Gaza City. So far, that hasn't developed. One thing that Marco Rubio did say, he said they support that Israel to defeat Hamas. And those were welcome words for Israel, for Prime Minister Netanyahu to have the backing of the administration now as they're going into such a critical phase of this war against Hamas.
All right, Chris Mitchell, 25 seconds left. What do we need to be praying for?
Peace of Jerusalem. Pray for protection for the IDF soldiers. Pray for the protection for the people in Gaza. Yes. Pray that this Hamas can finally be eliminated as a threat, and pray that the Lord will lead whatever happens after this war in Gaza in that particular area.
Chris Mitchell, always great to see you, my friend. Thanks so much for taking time to join us this evening.
Thanks, Tony.
All right, Chris Mitchell with CBN News from Israel. I do want to encourage you to pray. Pray for the peace of Israel, all of Israel. And that includes the Palestinians that are within the territory of Israel. Pray for the peace in the resolution of this conflict. Until next time, I leave you with the words of the Apostle Paul. Pray and stand.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com.